Yeah.
With the evolution of the concept of the importance of three-dimensional filling and the awareness of now ramifications and additional canal systems inside teeth, do you feel that it is better at this time to put emphasis on filling with a material that we're now familiar with, like gutta percha, and improving methods of delivery of gutta percha, say, into the canal system, rather than experimentation with other materials?
Well, I wrote about this in that Future of Endodontic chapter, and I wrote subtly but clearly, when I said that the last thing we need now are new materials and techniques. But what I think we have to do is even out, get those dentists in Arundel County into the 20th century. We have to even out things that we currently know. Because you see, on the thread of what I was saying in the last half hour or so, is that knowledge is very unevenly perceived by the dental profession generally. So I think the main thing we have to do now, is to teach people the things we now know and are learning, and get them to even out their ability to deliver endodontic service, to fill root canals, basically with materials that currently exist. I think that the search for all these other variations are ego-wise, which is reasonable, economics, which may or may not be as reasonable, and senses of frustration from those who couldn't deliver with things that are currently available. I think those three reasons, you get me? Somebody who's just inept and can't use what other people can use decides to do something new or material that can bring profit or just seeking recognition. These are all human characteristics, and I think this is understandable, but I don't think it's good necessarily for patients. I think what we ought to do now as educators is to get everybody up to a common level, which is currently potentially much higher than it is. You know, as you well know from your own practice, the ability to deliver quality endodontics is so much higher than what is being delivered, you know, across the country, around the world, by dentists in general, if not in general practice, dentists generally specialists and generalists. The whole thing's got to be pulled up to a new level. Maybe it's too much to ask, it's unrealistic to ask it all to be at the highest current peak. But I think it's reasonable to bring it generally up, to flatten it out a little bit at a new higher level. Yeah, I think this is basically
In your capacity as Dean for Continuing Education at the School of Graduate Dentistry, have you in the last 10 years seen a significant wave towards realization of this goal?
Absolutely. It's a little uncomfortable for endodontists to hear this, but it's not an insult in any way. We find people who come here and take a series of courses in continuing education end up doing endodontics, general dentists, as good as endodontists. But we find endodontists who come here and take a series of courses to do endodontics superior to the generalist and superior to what they did before. And we may have, you know, the most active continuing education program in endodontics in the world. My judgment is that I can see this happening. In the warm gutta percha courses, we don't show a single slide. It's only the product of what the people do, and they're superb. So I see this happening.
Okay.
It's just a slow process.
It's been my observation that people who I've recommended take your continuing education courses in endodontics, not only do they become more competent in their own personal delivery of endodontics, but the improvement that they can make as far as the diagnosis of the problem and the case selection, I find that from working with them in a referral type basis, that the relationship is always improved. And this is, I'm speaking 100%. 100% of the people who I've recommended turn out to be better referring people, do more endodontics in their office, but can still send out the difficult molar, the difficulty anterior, the difficult bicuspid, because of their realization
of what the potential can be and what their limitations are.
Is this a general?
Yes,
is this
right.
A generalization that you can live with?
Sure. What we try to teach them is that they could be as good as you. The only thing is they've got to do it as much as you and intensively as you do it, which they're not going to do. Now, there's no way that I'm going to shoot baskets like Bob Cousy. We're about the same age, because he's done so much more of it. I may shoot good baskets, you know, for a middle-aged dentist. But I teach them that if they wanted to and come back to school and do it continuously, they'll get terrific. There's no way they're going to do third molars under bridges the way you do. And then working back into less complicated problems, they begin to know where they can and where they can't. And then when they get to the point where they know what a superb result is within their capability, they want that same superb result in teeth that are beyond their mechanical dexterity, their practice, their training. I agree with you. There's another point, though, that goes from that. I hope that what I've done with endodontics is to try to make it a cognitive kind of activity. I don't mean an esoteric kind of activity. I'm amused when I find that Sam is now in a new field of pain control. Sam Seltzer, at age 62 or whatever he is, has entered a whole new field. And his latest brochures don't mention endodontics. Nerve pathways, mechanisms of pain, 2 3-day courses in it. He's doing a book in it. His whole experience in endodontics has been like an intellectual exercise rather than a living event. Now pain tantalizes him. So now he's going to be an expert in pain. He's an expert in pain, the way you can become an expert in selling options. Take 6 months off, do nothing but read about selling options, and after a while you know more than anybody in Worcester about selling options, and you'll give lectures on selling options, if that's what interests you. And you may get good at it. Endodontics has either had the absolute non-intellectual, who never thought through what he was doing anyway, or you had the guy like Sam, who made it an esoteric kind of event and he played with it intellectually, but didn't apply it to clinical situations. I'd like to feel that one of my contributions was, I hate to use the word, but Sargenti uses it, is to rationalize endodontics. But not so you can do it in 10 seconds. By the way, Mel stuff fills the root canal in 15 to 30 seconds if you read the stuff. But to rationalize the thing so that you can think it through, the diagnosis. What good is endodontics if you do it in the wrong tooth? Lord knows enough people do that. To think of it, what makes the pain? How can we control the pain? How can we do away with the pain? I can do away with the pain faster by telling you what to do clinically than to memorize the nerve pathways and not know how to do away with the pain clinically. How do you move your hand, your mirror, and the burr so you get the whole pulp out? How do you open up the access cavity so you can see where the canals are? How do you interpret the pain? How do you deal with it so you don't get called out of bed, you know, every night with some kind of emergency problem? How do you teach this to your local dentist so they let you do a CRP, a crescent pulpotomy, or they'll do it for you? And get confident that they don't have to go into those canals and mess it up. How do you get rid of all the nonsense and to begin to understand what makes a case work and what makes a case give trouble? Wet canals. Iatrogenic. We make them. Or they are made. They don't come that way. Yeah, I think that there's all... Endodontics needs an understanding, a comprehension about the simple biology that constitutes it. The major biologic elements that are involved in it, but not from an esoteric point of view. Practical biology, practical erudition, sensibility. And with that, of course, the endodontics is going to be a hell of a lot easier. There's a hell of a lot more to it than cleaning and shaping and packing a canoe. There's more to it than a technique.
One field, one other specialty in endodontics, in dentistry, that being oral surgery, more than any other specialty, seems to be contradictory to endodontics. Do you envision that changing?
Completely, sure. If you mean that the oral surgeon has a vested interest in doing apicoectomies and cutting out lesions of endodontic origin, and a vested interest in believing that they have to do so, because that's what it is, it's a fiscal and a academic vested interest. They've built their a phase of their work based on premises which we find to be false. My own personal feeling is a plague on your house. You're over the hill and you don't know it. Your concept is dying and you're not aware of it. I think the fact that we have John Richardson at this school, who is an oral pathologist who doesn't believe that old junk anymore, it's a great sign that things are changing. I think the fact that we're beginning to get oral surgeons who want to do retrogrades instead of just doing apicos is a feeling that they begin to understand about sealing the root canals, even though I don't think they belong there, because it's kind of a microsurgery event that most of them, anybody can learn this, but most of them are not suited for. But my own feeling in terms of your question again is tremendous optimism that the facts are speaking for themselves, and that as the generalists are going to learn this before the oral surgeons, right? There's no question of it. The generalists learn faster that the lesions heal. And as the generalists learn it, they will impose it on the oral surgeons. I don't feel any compulsion to address myself to oral surgeons. I have. But I don't feel it's any crusade. I feel a compulsion almost to address myself to general dentists. And as they understand, the rest of it will alter with it. It'll change. As we put out more endodontists who can, you know, get close to that 100%, then I've got more people out there who are doing it. Basically, what I'm doing can be done by other people with the same concept. If I do anything different, it's a little more compulsiveness, it's a little more care, it's a little more concern that we get up to the 100%. Aside from that, the principles I'm teaching can be done by any other intelligent, reasonably skillful person. And as we get more and more people out there doing it, as you know yourself, your own experience, then you rattle another oral surgeon, rattle in the sense, I don't mean to make him uncomfortable, but rattle his own concepts and say, what the hell, that Desilex is out there in his areas of healing. Maybe, who knows, maybe this stuff works. And then over a period of years, rather than with a frontal assault. I don't see a frontal assault on the apicoectomy by surgeons. I see a different kind of thing. In this school, I don't know if you know it, the oral surgery department can't do an apicoectomy. It's against the rules. They cannot. If it needs an apicoectomy, if should it need it for some reason, broken, it's an endodontic procedure. The oral we have extracted it from oral surgery in this school. Okay. It'll happen in other places. You know, it's going to happen. Some other endodontist is going to get jealous. He's going to go to his dean and say, how come they do it there? Why can't we get our oral surgeons to take out tumors and do orthognathic surgery and do the fun stuff? Leave this alone.
Does that include palatal roots and distal roots of like little molars and without exception?
Here, I'm going to shock you. I'm shocking you now. I'm doing more of those now. Okay. I don't know if I told you last week because these are thoughts in my mind last time we met. I'm doing more and more palatal roots because as endodontics evolves for other reasons, we're going to be left with the real specialty stuff. Mm-hmm. It isn't going to be the easy central incisor anymore. And we're going to have to do these. And we do them better.
Do you feel that just because of your association with filling techniques and the many years of, you know, what's 100% or 101% success, do you feel that sometimes you're not fully appreciated for the type of training that you have afforded to your students in surgical endodontics?
Yeah, I in a way, but it doesn't bother me. I'm amused by it in a way, used to be bothered perhaps. Some people will tell me about a chapter that Lupke writes on surgical endodontics that they like so much. My notes. No, it's my notes. One thing that maybe does disturb me, the ocean bind, Lupke flaps. Ray is a very, very close friend of mine, and you don't know, we recruited him for the school. I wanted him to come here when he left Kentucky. But, you know, that flap, that's my flap. That's the flap I introduced to Temple years ago. And other people who I don't like as well as Ray draw that flap in articles and claim some originality for it. I guess I'm not appreciated that much for it, but what the hell? I'm appreciated by a lot of people. I'm a very happy guy as far as that's concerned.
Your students appreciate you. Mm-hmm. And because from speaking to other BU-trained people, mm-hmm. very, very few of the Boston University-trained endodontists refer their surgical cases out in comparison to other graduates.
Right, we have a few, as you know. There are some we could put on the tape and it's not necessary, right, who find it more convenient for the way their practice runs to refer to. But right, most of our people do it. And I think we're going to have to do it.
And do palatal roots and do distal roots and little molars.
You know, right, we have a requirement for the students now. We didn't before. We found some fellows would leave with a lot of experience and others not. Mm-hmm. And now we have a requirement. They have to do 10 or 12 cases before they go, which is very good. And frankly, since this is all confidential, they may have to do it on cases that don't need it, but we insist that they get this experience. And in my mind, I can justify this completely. You know, there's a greater good being served, and as long as nobody is injured, and this is done, what the heck? If they're at Pittsburgh or someplace else where they do 50 surgical cases a year, which they have to.
I have all the surgeons that refer in cases for surgical intervention.
Right, and I do too. Some I won't say where, but some in this area refer cases in, and I think it's great. And they understand. I did one for the secretary of a surgeon who said he tried so many times and he couldn't succeed. Would I take a look? This is where it's going to be. The day of the easy income in endodontics by just being an endodontist and being alive is over. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely over.
So we're endodontics, I get the impression that we're in the problem-solving specialty. If it can be termed that way. Problem solving. Flare up, pain, swelling.
You're going to have to do a service to the guy out there, right. When I was in dental school, the oral surgeon on the staff of every school gave the lectures on the horrors of doing oral surgery, and he stood by when you made the phone call to bail you out. I'm afraid, you know, for our own comfort and digestive tracts and mental ease, that endodontics may end up in that kind of thing. See, my optimism leads me to believe that the generalist is going to be doing better work, that pre-doctoral programs will improve, that more endodontists will be doing better work. And you know from my San Diego paper, my prediction there's going to be too many endodontists, which has happened now in many parts of the country. So it's going to end up that the good guys are going to have to be doing more bailout. Two-thirds of what I see are retreatments. I sometimes have a whole day when I haven't had a tooth that somebody hasn't been into previously. And again, I don't know if I mentioned to you, I'm doing more and more surgery in all parts of the mouth. Patching something that's been botched previously. So I think we're entering into that area. But now we're speaking very parochially about ourselves. I think if we speak about patients in general, and dentists in general, there's going to be a lot more good endodontics being done by a broader spectrum of dentists.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one more question, and again, I'm not harboring on oral surgery and the fact that there is a vested interest as far as the removal of teeth and as far as apicoectomies. There's one other area where there's an overlap between endodontics and the specialty of oral surgery, and that involves fulminating infections of endodontic origin. Do you feel that endodontists in their training should be handling hospitalization of patients, cases that, you know, may even involve extraoral incisions for drainage? Do you relegate this? Do you give this to the oral surgeon?
I give that to the oral surgeon, Roger. And I give it to the oral surgeon the way the oral surgeon should give to us the endodontic surgery. I personally don't see enough of that fulminating fascial plane involvement, Ludwig's angina, posterior mediastinal involvement. I don't see enough of it in the course of a year to satisfy myself that I'm sufficiently expert in it. Or, to put it another way, I'm a great believer in specialists. I'd rather have the fellow who sees 10 of them a month, mm-hmm. even if the tooth's going to be extracted, but he has now developed the experience of seeing 10 of those a month. I don't think endodontists, by and large, with exceptions, but by and large, are going to see that much of it. If the guy sees that much of it and wants to develop an interest in it, fine. But I'd recommend, you know, to the students while they're here, unless they find they're in that kind of circumstance, to know about that, but to leave that in the hands of somebody, not just an average oral surgeon who doesn't know it either, but the guy in the community who sees a lot of that material because of the nature of his practice. And I'm inclined to feel that when you're in the mucobuccal fold, when you're in the palate, when you're in the areas that I'm in and out of all the time, surgically and non-surgically both, that's me. Because nobody can know more than somebody like me in the area that I'm involved with continuously. If you get a swelling below the myelohyoid muscle, I've only had, you know, a dozen in my life. I don't feel that I need it for my own ego to manage that case. I can well call somebody who sees a lot of that stuff, who may not be able to, more than likely can't do a retrograde the way I can. But if he has a practice that has patients hospitalized for Ludwig's, let him have it. And if that happens to be a physician, let him have that too. I don't want to stand on ceremonies if the patient's getting that sick. Whoever the individual is who has that. I'm willing to give that up like I'm willing. I don't argue the point of bleached teeth. If the operative dentist of the world wanted to say bleached teeth is a part of operative dentistry, I'd give that up. I could care less.
Have you ever done anything with tetracycline stained teeth? Have you
Yes.
pursued this to any satisfaction?
Well, that's different. not to any great satisfaction. I cannot, on the basis of my own experience, understand the results that other people write about. Now, Steve Cohn writes about 10 visits. Well, that's about right. But who the hell wants to put the patient through that? Some of the fellows in Indiana are talking about 2 and 3 visits. I can't get that. Mm-hmm. Now, I've bleached quite a number of tetracycline-stained teeth. But from a cost-effectiveness, time-effectiveness, practicality point of view, I'd have to consider that a very oddball kind of phenomenon. The trouble often is if you get a success with one after 5 visits, then you got to do another one, and then you have to do another one, mm-hmm. and the patient can grow old in your office. You can overheat the teeth and create pulp problems in the process. So I'd have to view that as a tangential technique in endodontics. Mm-hmm. And certainly not worthy of the American Association of Endodontics publishing a brochure on it for your waiting room. Mm-hmm. I don't solicit that kind of work. I view it just as a side look. And again, by the way, you know, not necessarily endodontics. I'd give that to operative dentistry without any qualms.
Somehow I think that operative dentists would rather give it to
endodontists. I think you're right.
Willingly.
I don't think it's as successful. Across the board. It hasn't been in my hands.
It hasn't been in my hands.
No. Don't be... I think you're coming up with the correct conclusion.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to say about, you know, where you feel the filling materials should go? I get the distinct impression that you're happy with the evolution, at least in endodontic circles, of the importance of three-dimensional filling. That you're satisfied that guttapercha is a proven material mm-hmm. with clinical significance, that you're not opposed to any way of introducing the guttapercha into the canal system as long as it can be made to fill the canal system three-dimensionally. And outside of possibly coming up with new ways of introducing and packing mm-hmm. it, you just feel that
right.
more people should know about it.
You can almost go back to a statement that I make often when people take courses or if I'm speaking to dentists. I myself, I tell them, wouldn't change anything unless I have a problem. If I have a problem, then I want to make a change. You take a distal buccal canal as I had today with an S-shaped curve in it. If somebody can package me a new way to shape that beautifully, you know, in 10 minutes, it doesn't exist, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to listen to him. I had some Italian here from Italy who was showing me some new machine he made. Well, he didn't convince me of anything on the base of what he was saying. But it would be nice to do that faster, equally effectively, shaped as physiologically, and ready to receive the filling. Yeah, sure. But packing a canal with warm guttapercha. I can teach this to kids fresh out of dental school. I can teach the 65-year-old dentist who haven't done a root canal since they were 35. It seems like an easy thing to do. So I'd have to agree with what you say. I think if there's an understanding of the importance of the root canal system, there's an understanding of shaping it and cleaning it, and an importance of obturating it in three dimensions, I don't perceive a problem in manipulating it at the present time. I'm afraid of a lot of the injectables. Not on the basis of the guy who is academically producing it. I'm afraid of it. And follow me, Roger, because this can be important to you. I'm afraid of getting the bad feeling about gut chloroperchy again, that people will say, I can shove this stuff in. Mm-hmm. The pulp tent, pressure syringe at first, Hydron, anything, okay, anything. And that people say, hey, here's stuff I can squeeze in. Then somebody might say, well, that's not what you do with it. What you're supposed to do is clean the canal and do this and do that. And the guy says, the hell with that. I got this stuff. I can squeeze this. I can make it go to the top. And then there's this potential problem. That's not to criticize, you know, the desire to innovate, but it's something you have to consider. That once it gets to the point where you can squeeze it in, you run the risk of people misinterpreting it and misusing it and say, boy, I got something I can squeeze. Anyway, it's not a new problem. It's been a problem. They were filling root canals with Jiffy tubes, you know, in Europe years ago to squeeze in. So there's something about the warm gutta-percha technique, at least, and this is not in defense of it, I don't think it needs any defense, in that it does ask you to fit something, and it does ask you to get it close, and it does ask you to warm it, and then just move it up the last little bit to get it to fit. That can't be abused. But on the other hand, I know your feelings too, any delivery system that gets it in and gets that stuff sealed off, I think is fine. Variations on a theme. Mm-hmm. Variations on a theme. It's still warm gutta-percha, and it's still being pushed up vertically, and it's variations. No.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for the interview, both today and earlier this summer. I found both sessions to be very enlightening, very rewarding for me as an endodontist, and I'm sure that when they are put to use, they will also be appreciated by dentistry as a whole.
Okay, I'm not through yet.
Okay. With that,
I hope you've got something on your tape.
With that, I have a little bit more tape left. I'll let you finish.
Okay. I forget what we covered last time exactly, and I would like to have a transcript. Leave the thing, Rick.
Okay, we have plenty.
I want to take this place now to mention some of the things that I feel I've been interested in endodontics, and the things that I do feel associated with, and where I think these things went, and where I'd like to see them go. You know, in my own personal identifications, the areas in which, is there enough tape on there?
Fine.
We got to put it down somewhere, Raj, so instead of my writing it down, I'm going to put it on your tape.
I have it here.
Well, it's not going to take that long. Mm-hmm. This kind of personal history goes on the basis of the controversies that I found myself involved in. But controversies in the sense of, what did I have to fight in the old days? Now, there's an interesting phenomenon, which this is all, you know, you're going to use what you're going to use and the other stuff otherwise, and I'm going to have a transcript for my use for what I want to do with it later. I spoke to Pete Simon down in Fort Worth, Texas the other day. He's a top-notch endodontist in Fort Worth. The years roll. Pete's probably 55 going out of 60. But he was filling my head with compliments about the changes I made in endodontics. Well, he was right, but he didn't have to do it, you know. But when I got off the phone, I said, he's right. He's right. He remembers those meetings of the AAE years ago when I was on the program every single year. And the truth is that whatever they were doing, wherever they were smoking, when I was on, they came into the room to hear, what's this kid going to say now? And I quickly developed a following. At least they're going to say, they're going to disagree before they heard. Or a lot of guys said, let's get some more out of him. Now, the stuff seemed revolutionary then. And I want to record it here because the thing that's happening is, I'm gratified. It doesn't seem so revolutionary anymore. But if we're talking about history, then I want to lay this thing down. My concept on drugs, that's a landmark in endodontics. And the people of Ray Abramson's age, and Pete Simon and some of the others, that's a landmark. I came into an era where they were using powerful drugs. The caustics, the PBSCs, we're not going to make a lesson on all that massive stuff. I came in and said, cool it. You don't need the drugs. It's too much. It's causing irritation and the inflammatory potential of drugs. To me, that was a major battle, and I feel won. Major battle, and I feel won. Another one was access cavities. You can't believe the abuse that I took by opening up the access cavities that are open today. It's simple logic. I have a concern that this is going to get lost, that people are going to forget. the grudging way in which they open the access cavities a little more. When I opened the access cavity, opened them. You know, years ago, came in and said, let's open them. Right? It was a revolution. Some are afraid of it today. I don't want one any bigger than it has to be. But as big as it should be, is bigger than most people were willing to accept then. The snake eye access cavities, I used to teach you guys about. The realities. So the inflammatory potential of drugs was not esoteric. I think it's made a fundamental change. Get those goddamn paper points out of the canals. Don't use harsh drugs and the whole bag that goes with it. The access cavities, I view as a major battle. It was a battle for me until we won people over. You know, open them up so you can see what's going on in there. What we discussed in length here today, three-dimensional root canal fillings. Major battle. And we said enough about that, but that's another major one. The 100% success. That's not bullshit. That's not for my own personal pleasure. That's to teach the profession that, damn it, this stuff does work. The biologic system we're dealing with has it. And that's another point, Raj, that I take as a point of pride. Not only noticing it, not only teaching it, but if you will, having the balls to get up there and take the brunt. Stand there to the whole endodontic profession and say, guys, we're not pussyfooting here. It's 100%. Now let's begin to understand it. Now we'll discuss it from there. So that's another major issue, okay? I consider major things, you know, to make them think about this. The what is going to be the new view of forgetting to speak about granulomas and cysts and think of lesions of endodontic origin. Change the whole terminology of it. Whole major area. So including the pathosis, the biology of it, of apical lesions, lesions of endodontic origin. Three-dimensionality, cleaning and shaping. I've been pleased that some people say nobody's articulated better than those two articles, the one in Dental Clinics and the one in the Cone Burns book. Cleaning, it's such common sense. Really cleaning and shaping, saying you can get it clean. Longland is here today talking about it with the students, but saying sometimes you can't. Well, the more you want to, the more you can. And I'm gratified to find that nobody can write an article anymore without saying cleaning and shaping. Everybody writes root canal system. I'm pleased with this. Seems like only common sense, but I stood there and said root canal system. I didn't put the